It spoke. Its voice came out quiet, smooth, melodious, words somehow slithering out through the bear's jaws and throat.
"Shiro, look at yourself, little fool. You are an old man. You were at the peak of your strength when last we met. You cannot defeat me now."
Shiro narrowed his eyes, his sword gripped in one hand, the length of wooden sheath held in the other.
"Did you come here to talk?"
Ursiel's head tilted to one side, and then the smooth voice murmured,
"No, indeed I did not."
It whirled, whipping its head toward me, and lunged. As it did, there was a rustle of cloth, and then an old overcoat spun through the air, spreading like a fisherman's net. It fell over Ursiel's face, and the demon drew up short with a frustrated howl. It reached up and tore the coat from its head. While it did, the tall, young black man stepped between Ursiel and me. As I watched, he drew a long, heavy saber from the scabbard at his hip. The sword hummed with the same power as Shiro's, though in a slight variation, a different note within the same chord. Silver light flared from the blade's steel, and behind the demon, Shiro's blade answered it with more of its own radiance. The young man looked back at me, and I caught a glimpse of dark, intense eyes before he faced the demon, and said in a rumbling basso, words flavored with a thick Russian accent,
"Ursiel, let him go! You have no power here!"
Ursiel hissed, the orange eyes blazing brighter by the moment.
"Sonya, traitor! Do you really think any of us fears even one of the three in your pathetic hands? So be it. I will take you all."
Sonya spread his empty hand to one side of his body in mocking invitation and said nothing. Ursiel roared and flew at Sonya. The big man extended the saber, and the weapon took Ursiel high on one shoulder, plunging through muscle and sinew. Sonya braced himself as the demon's body hit him, and though the impact drove his feet back across 6 inches of concrete, he held it up and away from me. Shiro let out a ringing cry I wouldn't have believed the little old man could make, and Ursiel screamed, thrashing and flailing. Sonya shouted something in what sounded like Russian and drove forward with both hands on the hilt of the impaling saber, overbearing Ursiel and sending the demon sprawling onto his back. Sonya followed, staying close, and I saw him throw his weight onto the demon as he twisted the hilt of the saber thrust through it. He'd been too aggressive. Ursiel's paw hit him squarely upon one shoulder, and I heard the snap of breaking bone. The blow threw the young man away from the demon, and he rolled across the ground and into a wall, an explosive breath of pain forced from him as he hit. Ursiel recovered its feet, tore the saber from its shoulder with a jerk of its jaws, and went after Sonya, but the white-haired old man menaced its flank, forcing it away from the wounded man, and incidentally, from me. For a few seconds, the old man and the demon circled each other. Then the demon lashed out at Shiro, a flurry of slashes with its claws. The old man ducked them, retreating, his sword flickering and cutting. Twice he left cuts on the demon's paws, but though it screamed in rage, it only seemed to grow less intimidated, more angry. The old man's breathing grew visibly labored.
"Age," Ursiel's voice purred amidst its attack. "Death comes, old man. Its hand is on your heart now, and your life has been spent in vain."
"Let him go!"
spat the old man between breaths. Ursiel laughed again, and the green pair of eyes glowed brighter. Another voice, this one not at all beautiful, the words twisted and snarling, said,
"Stupid preacher! Time to die, like the Egyptian did."
Shiro's expression changed from stolid, controlled ferocity to something much sadder, much more resolved. He faced the demon for a moment, panting, and then nodded.
"So be it."
The demon drove forward, and the old man gave ground, slowly forced into a corner of the alley.
He seemed to be doing pretty well until one close swipe of the demon's claws caught the glowing silver blade near its hilt and sent it spinning away. The old man gasped and pressed back against the corner, panting, holding his right hand against the left side of his chest.
"So it ends, knight," purred the smooth demon voice of Ursiel.
"Aye,"
the old man agreed quietly. He looked up above him, at a fire escape platform 10 feet off the ground. A shadowed figure dropped over the rail of the platform, steel rasping as it did. There was a low thrum of power, a flash of silver, and the hiss of a blade cutting the air. The shadowy figure landed in a crouch beside the creature. The demon Ursiel jerked once, body stiffening. There was a thump. Then its body toppled slowly over to one side, leaving its monstrous head lying on the alley floor. The light died from its four eyes. The third knight rose away from the demon's corpse. Tall and broad-shouldered, his close-cut hair dark and feathered with silver, Michael Carpenter snapped the blade of his broadsword, Amorakius, to one side, clearing droplets of blood from it. He put it back into its sheath, staring down at the fallen demon, and shook his head. Shiro straightened, his breathing quick but controlled, and went to Michael's side. He gripped the larger man's shoulder and said, "It had to be done." Michael nodded. The smaller knight recovered the second sword, cleared the blade, and returned it to its wooden sheath. Not far from me, the third knight, the young Russian, pushed himself up from the ground. One of his arms dangled uselessly, but he offered the other to me. I took his hand and rose on wobbly legs.
"You are well?"
he asked, his voice quiet. "Peachy," I responded, wobbling. He arched an eyebrow at me, then shrugged, and went to recover his blade from the alley floor. The after-effects of the soul gaze had finally begun to fade, and the simple shock and confusion began to give way to a redundant terror. I hadn't been careful enough. One of the bad guys had caught me off guard, and without intervention, I would have been killed to death. It wouldn't have been anything quick and painless, either. Without Michael and his two companions, the demon Ursiel would have torn me limb from literal limb, and I wouldn't have been able to do a damn thing about it. I had never encountered a psychic presence of such raw magnitude as upon the great stone cliff face. Not up close and personal like that, anyway. The first shot I'd taken at him had surprised and annoyed him, but he had been ready for the second blast and swatted aside my magical fire like an insect. Whatever Ursiel had been, he had been operating on a completely different order of magnitude than a mere punk of a mortal wizard like me. My psychic defenses aren't bad, but they had been crushed like a beer can under a bulldozer. That, more than anything, scared the snot out of me. I had tried my psychic strength against more than a few bad guys, and I had never felt so badly outclassed. Oh, I knew there were things out there stronger than me, sure, but none of them had ever jumped me in a dark alley. I shook and found a wall to lean on until my head cleared a little, and then walked stiffly over to Michael. Bits of broken glass fell from folds in my duster. Michael glanced up as I came over to him.
"Harry," he said.
"It isn't that I'm not glad to see you," I said, "but you couldn't have jumped down and beheaded the monster about 2 minutes sooner?" Michael was usually pretty good about taking a joke. This time he didn't even smile.
"No, I'm sorry."
I frowned at him. "How did you find me? How did you know?"
"Good advice."
Which could have been anything from spotting my car nearby to being told by an angelic chorus. The Knights of the Cross always seemed to turn up in bad places when they were badly needed. Sometimes coincidence seemed to go to incredible lengths to see to it that they were in the right place at the right time. I didn't think I wanted to know. I nodded at the demon's fallen body and said, "What the hell was that thing?"
"He wasn't a thing, Harry," Michael said.
He continued staring down at the remains of the demon, and just about then they started shimmering. It only took a few seconds for the demon to dissolve into the form of the man I'd seen in the soul gaze, thin, gray-haired, dressed in rags. except that in the soul gaze, his head hadn't been lying 3 feet away like that. I didn't think a severed head should have held an expression, but it did. One of absolute terror, his mouth locked open in a silent scream. The sigil I'd seen on the cliff face stood out on his forehead like a fresh scab, dark and ugly. There was a glitter of orange-red light. The sigil vanished, and something clinked on the asphalt. A silver coin, a little smaller than a quarter, rolled away from the man's head, bounced against my foot, and then settled onto the ground. A second later, the body let out a hissing, sighing sound and began to run with streaks of green-black goo. The body just deflated in on itself, noxious fumes and a spreading puddle of disgusting slime, the only things remaining. "That's it," I said, staring down and trying to keep myself from visibly trembling. "The weirdness has just gone off the end of my meter. I'm going home and going to bed." I bent to recover the coin before the slime engulfed it. The old man snapped his cane at my wrist, growling, "No!" It stung. I jerked my hand back, shaking my fingers, and scowled at him. "Stars and stones, Michael, who is this guy?" Michael drew a square of white cloth from his pocket and unfolded it. "Shiro Yoshimo. He was my teacher when I became a Knight of the Cross." The old man grunted at me. I nodded at the wounded man and asked, "How about him?" The tall black man glanced up at me as the old knight began examining his arm. He looked me up and down without any sign of approval, glowered, and said, "Sonya." "The newest of our order," Michael added. He shook out the cloth, revealing 2 pairs of crosses embroidered in silver thread upon it. Michael knelt down and picked up the coin through the cloth, turned it over, then folded the cloth completely around the silver. I frowned down at the coin as he did. One side bore some ancient portrait, maybe of a man's profile. The opposite side had some other design that was hidden under a stain in the shape of a rune, the one I'd seen on the demon Ursiel's forehead. "What's that?" I asked.
"Shiro was protecting you," Michael said, rather than answering the question.
Michael looked over at Shiro, who stood with a towering Sonya, and asked, "How is he?"
"Broken arm," the old man reported. "We should get off the street."
"Agreed," rumbled Sonya.
The older knight fashioned a makeshift sling from the shredded overcoat, and the tall young man slipped his arm into it without a sound of complaint.
"You'd better come with us, Harry," Michael said. "Father Forthill can get you a cot."
"Whoa, whoa," I said. "You never answer my question. What was that?" Michael frowned at me and said,
"It's a long story and there's little time."
I folded my arms. "Make time. I'm not going anywhere until I know what the hell is going on here." The little old knight snorted and said,
"Hell, that is what's going on."
He opened his hand to me and said,
"Please give them back."
I stared at him for a second, until I remembered his spectacles. I handed them to him, and he put them on, making his eyes goggle out hugely again.
"Wait a minute," I said to Michael. "This thing was one of the fallen?"
Michael nodded, and a chill went through me.
"That's impossible," I said. "The fallen can't do things like that."
I gestured at the puddle of slime.
"They aren't allowed."
"Some are," Michael said, his voice quiet. "Please believe me. You are in great danger. I know what you've been hired to find, and so do they."
Shiro stalked down to the end of the alley and swept his gaze around.
"Oi! Michael, we must go."
"If he will not come, he will not come," Sonya said.
He glared at me, then followed Shiro.
"Michael,"
I began.
"Listen to me," Michael said.
He held up the folded white cloth.
"There are more where this one came from, Harry. 29 of them. And we think they're after you."
Chapter 7. I followed Michael's white pickup truck in the Blue Beetle to St. Mary of the Angels Cathedral. It's a big, big church, a city landmark. If there's anything you like in the way of Gothic architecture, you can find it somewhere on St. Mary's. We parked near the back of the cathedral and went to the delivery entrance, a plain oak door framed by lovingly tended rose vines. Michael knocked at the door, and I heard the sound of multiple bolts being undone before the door opened. Father Anthony Forthill opened the door. He was in his late 50s, balding, and carried a comfortable weight of years. He wore black slacks and a black shirt, the stark white square of his clerical collar sharply delineated. He was taller than Shiro, but a lot shorter than everyone else there, and beneath his glasses his eyes looked strained.
"Success?" he asked Michael.
"In part," Michael responded. He held up the folded cloth and said, "Put this in the cask, please, and we'll need to splint an arm." Forthill winced and accepted the folded cloth with the kind of ginger reverence paid only to explosives and samples of lethal viruses.
"Right away. Good evening, Mr. Dresden. Come in, all of you."
"Father," I answered, "you look like my day so far." Forthill tried to smile at me, then padded away down a long hallway. Michael led us deeper into the church, up a flight of stairs to a storage room whose boxes had been stacked to the ceiling to make room for a number of folding cots, blocking the view of any windows. A mismatched pair of old lamps lit the room in soft gold.
"I'll get food, something to drink," Michael said quietly. He headed back out of the room. "And I need to call Charity.
Sonia, you'd better sit down until we can see to your arm."
"I'll be fine," Sonia said. "I will help with food."
Shiro snorted and said,
"Sit, boy."
He headed for the door, catching up to Michael, and said,
"Call your wife. I will do the rest."
The two left together, their voices lowering to bare murmurs as they entered the hall. Sonia glowered at the door for a moment and then settled down on one of the bunks. He looked around at the room for a moment and then said,
"You use the forces of magic, I take it."
I folded my arms and leaned against the wall.
"What gave it away?"
He bared his teeth, white against his dark skin.
"How long have you been a Wiccan?"
"A what?"
"A pagan, a witch."
"I am not a witch," I said, glancing out the door. "I am a wizard." Sonia frowned.
"What is the difference?"
"Wizard has a Z." He looked at me blankly. "No one appreciates me," I muttered. "Wicca is a religion. It's a little more fluid than most, but it's still a religion."
"And?"
"And I'm not really big on religion. I do magic, sure, but it's like being a mechanic or an engineer. There are forces that behave a certain way. If you know what you're doing, you can get them to work for you, and you don't really need a god or a goddess or a whatever to get involved." Sonia's expression became surprised.
"You are not a religious man, then?"
"I wouldn't burden any decent system of faith by participating in it." The tall Russian regarded me for a moment and then nodded slowly.
"I feel the same way."
I felt my eyebrow arch, Spock-like. "That's a joke, right?" He shook his head.
"It is not. I have been an atheist since childhood."
"You've got to be kidding me. You're a Knight of the Cross."
"Duh," he said.
"So if you're not religious, you risk your life to help other people because..."
"Because it must be done,"
he answered without hesitation.
"For the good of the people. Some must place themselves in harm's way. Some must pledge their courage and their lives to protect the community."
"Just a minute," I said. "You became a Knight of the Cross because you were a communist?" Sonia's face twisted with revulsion.
"Certainly not, Trotsky. We're different."
I stopped myself from bursting out in laughter, but it was a near thing. "How did you get your sword?" He moved his good hand to rest on the hilt of the blade where it lay beside him on the cot.
"Esparakios. Michael gave it to me."
"Since when has Michael gone running off to Russia?"
"Not that Michael," Sonia said.
He pointed a finger up.
"That Michael."
I stared at him for a minute and then said,
"So,
You get handed a holy sword by an archangel, told to go fight the forces of evil, and you somehow remain an atheist? Is that what you're saying? Sonya's scowl returned. Doesn't that strike you as monumentally stupid? His glare darkened for maybe a minute before he took a deep breath and nodded.
Perhaps some could argue that I am agnostic.
Agnostic?
One who does not commit himself to a certain belief in a divine power, he said.
I know what it means, I said. What shocks me is that you think it applies to you. You've met more than one divine power. Hell, one of them broke your arm not half an hour ago.
Many things can break an arm. You yourself said that you do not need a god or goddess to define your beliefs about the supernatural.
Yeah, but I'm not agnostic, just nonpartisan. Theological Switzerland, that's me, Sonya said.
Semantics. I do not understand your point.
I took a deep breath, still holding back the threat of giggles, and said, Sonya, my point is that you have got to be more than a little thick to stand where you are, having seen what you've seen, and claim that you aren't sure whether or not there is a god. He lifted his chin and said,
Not necessarily. It is possible that I am mad, and all of this is a hallucination.
That's when I started laughing. I just couldn't help it. I was too tired and too stressed to do anything else. I laughed and enjoyed it thoroughly while Sonya sat on his cot and scowled at me, careful not to move his wounded arm. Shiro appeared at the door, bearing a platter of sandwiches and deli vegetables. He blinked through his owlish glasses at Sonya and then at me. He said something to Sonya in what I took to be Russian. The younger knight transferred his scowl to Shiro, but nodded his head in a gesture deep enough to be part bow, before he rose, claimed two sandwiches in one large hand, and walked out. Shiro waited until Sonya was gone before he set the platter down on a card table. My stomach went berserk at the sight of the sandwiches. Heavy exertion coupled with insane fear does that to me. Shiro gestured at the plate and pulled a couple of folding chairs. I sat down, nabbed a sandwich of my own, and started eating. Turkey and cheese. Heaven. The old knight took a sandwich of his own and ate with what appeared to be a similar appetite. We munched for a while in contented silence before he said, Sonya told you about his beliefs. I felt the corners of my mouth start to twinge as another smile threatened. Yeah. Shiro let out a pleased snort. Sonya is a good man. I just don't get why he'd be recruited as a Knight of the Cross. Shiro looked at me over the glasses, chewing. After a while, he said,
Man sees faces, sees skin, flags, membership lists, files.
He took another large bite, ate it, and said,
God sees hearts.
If you say so, I said. He didn't answer. Right about the time I finished my sandwich, Shiro said,
You are looking for the shroud.
That's confidential, I said.
If you say so,
he said, using my own inflection on the words. The wrinkles at the corners of his eyes deepened.
Why?
Why what?
Why are you looking for it? He asked, chewing.
If I am, and I'm not saying that I am, I'm doing it because I've been hired to look for it.
Your job, he said.
Yeah.
You do it for money, he said.
Yeah.
Hmm,
he said, and pushed his glasses up with his pinky.
Do you love money, then, Mr. Dresden?
I picked up a napkin from one side of the platter and wiped my mouth. I used to think I loved it, but now I realize that it's just dependency. Shiro let out an explosive bark of laughter and rose, chortling.
Sandwich okay?
Super. Michael came in a few minutes later, his face troubled. There wasn't a clock in the room, but it had to have been well after midnight. I suppose that if I had called Charity Carpenter that late, I'd be troubled after the conversation, too. She was ferocious where her husband's safety was concerned, especially when she'd heard that I was around. Okay, admittedly, Michael had gotten pretty thoroughly battered whenever he came along on a case with me. But all the same, I didn't think it was fair of her. It wasn't like I did it on purpose. Charity wasn't happy, I asked.
Michael shook his head. She's worried. Is there a sandwich left? There were a couple. Michael took one, and I took a second one, just to keep him company. While we ate, Shiro got out his sword and a cleaning kit and started wiping down the blade with a soft cloth and some kind of oil. Harry, Michael said finally, I have to ask you for something. It's very difficult, and it's something that, under normal circumstances, I wouldn't even consider doing. Name it, I said between chews. At the time, I meant it literally. Michael had risked his life for me more than once. His family had been endangered the last time around, and I knew him well enough to know that he wouldn't ask something unreasonable. Just name it. I owe you. Michael nodded, then looked at me steadily and said, Get out of this business, Harry. Get out of town for a few days, or stay home, but get out of it, please. I blinked at him. You mean you don't want my help? I want your safety, Michael said. You are in great danger. You're kidding me, I said. Michael, I know how to handle myself. You should know that by now. Handle yourself, Michael said. Like you did tonight. Harry, if we hadn't been there... What? I snapped. I'd have been dead. It isn't like it isn't going to happen sooner or later. There are enough bad guys after me that one of them is eventually going to get lucky, so what else is new? You don't understand, Michael said. I understand, all right, I said. One more wacky B-horror movie reject tried to kill me. It's happened before. It'll probably happen again. Shiro said, without looking up from his sword, Ursiel did not come to kill you, Mr. Dresden. I considered that in another pregnant silence. The lamps buzzed a little. Shiro's cleaning cloth whispered over the steel of his sword. I watched Michael's face and asked, Why was he there, then? I had to put money down that it was a demon, but it was just a shape change. There was a mortal inside it. Who was he? Michael's gaze never wavered. His name was Rasmussen. Ursiel took him in 1849 on his way to California. I saw him, Michael. I looked in his eyes. Michael winced. I didn't know that. He was a prisoner in his own soul, Michael. Something was holding him, something big. Ursiel, I guess. He's one of the fallen, isn't he? Michael nodded. How the hell does that happen? I thought the fallen aren't allowed to take away free will. They aren't, Michael said. But they are allowed to tempt. And the Denarians have more to offer than most. Denarians? I asked. The Order of the Blackened Denarius, Michael said. They see an opportunity in this matter. A chance to do great harm. Silver coins. I took a deep breath. Like the one you wrapped up in blessed cloth. 30 pieces of silver, huh? He nodded. Whoever touches the coins is tainted by the fallen within. Tempted. Given power. The fallen leads the mortal deeper and deeper into its influence. Never forcing them. Just offering. Until eventually they have surrendered enough of themselves, and the thing gets control of them, I finished. Michael nodded, like Rasmussen. We try to help them. Sometimes the person realizes what is happening, wants to escape their influence. When we face them, we try to wear the demon down, give the person taken the chance to escape. And that's why you kept talking to it, until its voice changed. But Rasmussen didn't want to be free, did he? Michael shook his head. Believe it or not, Michael, I've been tempted once or twice. I can handle it. No, Michael said. You can't. Against the Denarians, few mortals can. The fallen know our weaknesses, our flaws, how to undermine. Even warned and aware of them, they have destroyed men and women for thousands of years. I said I'll be fine, I growled. Shiro grunted.
Pride before fall.
I gave him a sour glance. Michael leaned forward and said, Harry, please. I know that your life has not been an easy one. You're a good man. But you are as vulnerable as anyone. These enemies don't want you dead. He looked down at his hands. They want you. Which scared me. Really,
scared me. Maybe because it seemed to disturb Michael so much, and very little disturbs him. Maybe because I had seen Rasmussen, and would always be able to see him there, trapped, wildly laughing. Or maybe it was because part of me wondered if it would be so impossible to find a way to use the power the coin obviously offered. If it had made some random schmuck on the way to pan for gold into a killing machine that it took all 3 Knights of the Cross to handle, what could someone like me do with it? Beat the living snot out of Duke Paolo Ortega, that's for sure. I blinked, refocusing my eyes. Michael watched me, his expression pained, and I knew that he'd guessed at my thoughts. I closed my eyes, shame making my stomach uneasy.
"You're in danger, Harry," Michael said. "Leave the case alone."
"If I was in so much danger," I responded, "why did Father Vincent come and hire me?"
"Fort Hill asked him not to," Michael said. "Father Vincent disagrees with Fort Hill on how supernatural matters are to be handled."
I stood up and said, "Michael, I'm tired. I'm really damn tired."
"Harry," Michael chided me.
"Darned," I mumbled. "Darned tired. Darn me unto heck." I headed for the door and said, "I'm heading home to get some sleep. I'll think about it." Michael stood up and Shiro with him, both of them facing me.
"Harry," Michael said, "you are my friend. You've saved my life. I've named a child for you. But stay out of this business. For my sake, if not for your own."
"And if I don't," I asked, "then I'll have to protect you from yourself. In the name of God, Harry, please don't push this." I turned and left without saying goodbye. In this corner, one missing shroud, one impossibly and thoroughly dead corpse, one dedicated and deadly vampire warlord, 3 holy knights, 29 fallen angels, and a partridge in a pear tree. And in the opposite corner, one tired, bruised, underpaid professional wizard, threatened by his allies and about to get dumped by his would-be girlfriend for John Q. Humdrum. Oh, yeah. Definitely bedtime. Chapter 8. I fumed and brooded all the way back to my apartment, the Beetle's engine sputtering nervously the whole time. Mister was sitting at the top of the steps and let out a plaintive meow as I shut and locked up my car. Though I kept my blasting rod and shield bracelet ready in case any vanilla goons were waiting around with more silenced guns, I was fairly confident no preternasties were hanging around in ambush. Mister tended to make lots of noise and then leave whenever supernatural danger was around, which just goes to show that my cat has considerably more sense than me. Mister slammed his shoulder against my legs and didn't quite manage to trip me into falling down the stairs. I didn't waste any time getting inside and locked up behind me. I lit a candle, got out some cat food and fresh water for Mister's bowls, and spent a couple minutes pacing back and forth. I glanced at my bed and wrote it off as a useless idea. I was too worked up to sleep, even tired as I was. I was already chin-deep in alligators and sinking fast. "Right then, Harry," I mumbled. "Might as well do some work." I grabbed a heavy, warm robe off its hook, shoved aside one of my rugs, and opened the trapdoor leading down to the sub-basement. A folding ladder staircase led down to the damp stone chamber beneath where I kept my lab, and I padded down it, my robe's hem dragging against the wooden steps. I started lighting candles. My lab, barring a brief bout of insanity, generally reflects the state of my own mind, cluttered, messy, unorganized, but basically functional. The room isn't large. 3 work tables line 3 of the walls in a U shape, and a 4th table runs down the center of the U, leaving a narrow walkway around it. Wire utility shelves line the walls above the tables. Piled on the shelves and tables are a vast array of magical ingredients, plus that sort of miscellaneous domestic clutter that in households of more substance always winds up in a big drawer in the kitchen.
Books, notebooks, journals, and papers line the shelves, together with containers and boxes and pouches full of all sorts of herbs, roots, and magical ingredients, from a bottle of snake hisses to a vial of milk thistle extract. At the far end of the room there was a patch of floor kept completely clear of all clutter. A copper ring set into the stone of the floor, my summoning circle, resided there. Experience had shown me that you never can tell when you might need a ritual circle to defend yourself from magical attack, or for its other, most obvious use, keeping a denizen of the Never-Never a temporary prisoner. One of the shelves had less on it than the others. At either end rested a candle holder, long since overrun with many colors of melted wax until they were nothing but mounds, like a honeybee Vesuvius. Books, mostly paperback romances, and various small and feminine articles took up the rest of the shelf, but for where a bleached human skull sat in the middle. I picked up a pencil and rapped it against the shelf. Bob! Bob, wake up! Work to be done! Twin points of orange and gold light kindled in the shadows of the skull's eye sockets, and grew brighter as I went about the room lighting a half a dozen candles and a kerosene lamp. The skull rattled a little, and then said,
"It's only a few hours before dawn, and you're just starting up. What gives?"
I started getting out beakers and vials and a small alcohol burner. "More trouble," I said. "It's been one hell of a day." I told Bob the Skull about the television studio, the vampire's challenge, the hitman, the missing shroud, and the plague-filled corpse.
"Wow. You don't do things halfway, do you, Harry?"
"Advise now, critique later. I'm going to look into things and whip up a potion or two, and you're going to help."
"Right," Bob said. "Where do you want to start?"
"With Ortega. Where's my copy of the Accords?"
"Cardboard box," Bob said. "Third shelf on the bottom row, behind the pickling jars."
I found the box and pawed through it until I had found a vellum scroll tied shut with a white ribbon. I opened it and peered down at the handwritten calligraphy. It started off with the word "insomuch," and the syntax got more opaque from there.
"I can't make heads or tails of this," I said. "Where's the section about duels?" "Fifth paragraph from the end. You want the Cliff's Notes version?"
I rolled the scroll shut again. "Hit me."
"It's based on the code Duello," Bob said. "Well, technically it's based on much older rules that eventually inspired the code Duello, but that's just chickens and eggs. Ortega is the challenger, and you're the challenged."
"I know that. I get to pick the weapons and the ground, right?"
"Wrong," Bob said. "You pick the weapons, but he gets to choose the time and location."
"Damn," I muttered. I was going to take high noon out in a park somewhere. "But I guess I can just say that we'll duel with magic."
"If it's one of the available choices, it almost always is."
"Who decides?"
"The vampires and the council will pick from a list of neutral emissaries. The emissary decides."
I nodded. "So if I don't have it as an option, I'm screwed, right? I mean, magic, wizard, kind of my bag." Bob said,
"Yeah, but be careful. It's got to be a weapon that he can use. If you pick one he can't, he can refuse it and force you to take your second choice."
"Meaning what?"
"Meaning that regardless of what happens, if he doesn't want to fight you in magic, he won't have to. Ortega didn't get to be a warlord without thinking things through, Harry. Odds are that he has a good idea what you can do, and has planned accordingly. What do you know about him?"
"Not much. Presumably he's tough." Bob's eyelights stared at me for a minute.
"Well, Napoleon, I'm sure he'll never overcome that kind of tactical genius."
I flicked my pencil at the skull in annoyance. It bounced off a nose hole. "Get to the point."
"The point is that you'd be better off taking something you can predict."
"I'm better off not fighting to begin with," I said. "Do I need to get a second?"
"You both do," Bob said. "The seconds will work out the terms of the duel. His should be getting in touch with yours at some point."
I don't have one." Bob's skull turned a bit on its shelf and banged its forehead gently into the brick wall a few times.
"Then get one, dolt, obviously."
I got another pencil and a pad of yellow-lined paper and wrote "to do" across the top and "ask Michael about duel" underneath it. Okay, and I want you to find out whatever you can about Ortega before dawn.
Check,
Bob said.
I have your permission to come out?
Not yet. There's more. Bob's eyelids rolled.
Of course there's more. My job sucks.
I got out a jug of distilled water and a can of Coke. I opened the can, took a sip, and said, That corpse Murphy showed me. Plague curse?
Probably, Bob agreed. But if it really was that many diseases, it was a big one.
How big?
Bigger than that spell the Shadow Man was using to tear hearts out a few years ago.
I whistled. And he was running it off of thunderstorms and ceremonial rites, too.
What would it take to power a curse that strong? Curses aren't really my thing, Bob hedged. But a lot. Like maybe tapping into a sorceress ley line or a human sacrifice.
I sipped more Coke and shook my head. Someone is playing some serious hardball, then. Bob mused.
Maybe the wardens used it to get nasty on a Red Court agent.
They wouldn't, I said. They wouldn't use magic like that. Even if technically it was the diseases that killed the guy, it's too damn close to breaking the first law.
Who else would have that kind of power? Bob asked me.
I turned to a fresh page and sketched out a rough version of the tattoo on the corpse. I held it up to show it to Bob. Someone who didn't like this, maybe?
Eye of Thoth, Bob supplied. That the tattoo on the corpse?
Yeah. Was this guy in someone's secret club?
Maybe. The eye is a pretty popular occult symbol, though, so you can't rule out the possibility that he was an independent.
Okay, I said. So, who uses it?
Plenty of groups. Brotherhoods connected to the White Council, historic societies, a couple of fringe groups of occult scholars, personality cults, television psychics, comic book heroes.
I get the point, I said. I turned to a fresh page and from razor-sharp memory sketched out the symbol I'd seen on the demon Urseal's forehead. Do you recognize this? Bob's eyelids widened.
Are you insane? Harry, tear that paper up! Burn it!
I frowned.
Bob, wait a minute. Do it now!
A skull's voice was frightened, and I get nervous when Bob gets frightened. Not much can scare Bob out of his usual wise-ass commentator state of mind. I tore up the paper. I guess you recognize it.
Yeah, and I'm not having anything to do with that bunch.
I didn't hear that, Bob. I need information on them. They're in town. They've taken a shot at me, and I'm betting they're after the shroud.
Let them have it, Bob said. Seriously, you've got no idea the kind of power this group has.
Fallen, I know, I said. Order of the Blackened Denarius. But they have to play by the rules, right?
Harry, it isn't just the Fallen. The people they've taken are nearly as bad. They're assassins, poisoners, warriors, sorcerers.
Sorcerers?
The coins make them effectively immortal. Some of the Order have had 1,000 years to practice, and maybe more. That much time, even modest talents can grow teeth. Never mind everything experience would have taught them, everything they could have found to make themselves stronger over the years. Even without infernal superpowers, they'd be badass.
I frowned and tore the bits of paper into smaller bits. Badass enough to manage that curse?
There's no question that they would have the skill. Maybe enough that they wouldn't need as big a power source.
Great, I said and rubbed at my eyes. All right, then. Big leaguers all around. I want you to track down the shroud.
No can do, Bob said.
Give me a break. How many pieces of 2,000-year-old linen are in town?
That's not the point, Harry. The shroud is...
Bob seemed to struggle to find words.
It doesn't exist on the same wavelength as me. It's out of my jurisdiction.
What are you talking about?
I'm a spirit of intellect, Harry. Of reason, logic. The shroud isn't about logic. It's an artifact of faith.
What? I demanded. That doesn't make any sense.
You don't know everything, Harry, Bob said. You don't even know a lot. I can't touch this. I can't come anywhere near it. And if I even try, I'll be crossing boundaries I shouldn't. I'm not going up against angels, Dresden, fallen or otherwise.
I sighed and lifted my hands. Fine, fine. Is there someone I can talk to?
Bob was quiet for a moment before he said,
Maybe. Ulsharavas.
Ulsha-who?
Ulsharavas. She's an ally of the Loa, an oracle spirit. There's details about halfway through your copy of Dumont's Guide to Divinationators.
How are her prices?
Reasonable, Bob said. You've got everything you need for the calling. She isn't usually malicious.
Isn't usually?
The Loa are basically good guys, but they all have their darker aspects, too. Ulsharavas is a pretty gentle guide, but she's been harsh before. Don't let your guard down.
I won't, I said, and frowned. One more thing. Swing by Marcone's place and see if there's anything interesting there. You don't have to go all David Niven, just take a look around.
You think Marcone's involved in this one?
His thugs already took a poke at me. I might as well find out whatever I can. I give you permission to leave in pursuit of that information, Bob. Get back before dawn. Oh, do we still have that recipe for the antivenom to vampire spit? A cloud of orange lights flowed out of the skull across the table and then up the stairs. Bob's voice, oddly modulated, floated back to me.
Red notebook. Don't forget to light the ward flame while I'm gone.
Yeah, yeah, I muttered. I gave Bob a minute to clear my wards, then got down a 3-candle holder with green, yellow, and red candles on it. I lit the green one and set the candle holder aside. I got out Dumont's guide and read over the entry for Ulsharavas. It looked pretty simple, though you couldn't be too careful whenever you called something in from the Never Never. I took a couple of minutes to gather what I'd need. The oracle spirit couldn't put together a body for herself, not even a nebulous cloud of light like Bob could. She required a homunculus to manifest in the mortal world. Dumont recommended a newly dead corpse, but as the only one I was likely to find was my own, I needed a substitute. I found it in another box and plopped it down in the center of my summoning circle. I added a cup of whiskey and a freshly opened tin of Prince Albert's chewing tobacco to the circle, the required down payment to convince Ulsharavas to show up. It was the last of my whiskey and the last of the tins of tobacco, so I added Get More Scotch and Prince Albert in a Can to my to-do list and stuck it in my pocket. I spent a couple of minutes sweeping the floor around the circle so that I wouldn't kick a stray hair or bit of paper across the circle and flub it up. After a brief deliberation, I chalked down another circle outside the copper one. Then I took a moment to go over the guide a last time and to clear my head of distractions. I took a deep breath and gathered in my strength. Then I focused, reached down, and touched the copper circle, willing a tiny jolt of power into it. The summoning circle closed. I felt it as a tingling prickle on the back of my neck and a faint warmth on the skin of my face. I repeated the process with a chalk circle, adding a second layer, and then knelt down by the circle, lifting both hands, palms up. Ulsharavas, I murmured, willing energy into the words. My voice shook oddly, skittering around tones in what seemed a random fashion. Ulsharavas. Ulsharavas. One lost in ignorance seeks you. One darkened by the lack of knowledge seeks your light. Come, guardian of memory, sentinel of the yet to come, accept this offering and join me here. At the conclusion of the ritual words, I released the power I'd been holding, sending it coursing from me into the circle, and through it to seek out the oracle spirit in the Never Never. The response came immediately. A sudden swirl of light appeared within the copper circle, and briefly made the barrier around it visible as a curved plane of blue sparkles. The light drizzled down over the homunculus, and a moment later it twitched, then sat up. Welcome, Oracle, I said. Bob the Skull thought you might be of some help. The homunculus sat up and stretched out pudgy arms. Then it blinked, looked at its arms, and rose to stare down at itself. It looked up at me with one eyebrow raised and asked in a tiny voice,
"A Cabbage Patch doll? You expect me to help you while wearing this?"
It was a cute doll. Blonde ringlets fell to her plush shoulders, and she wore a pink and blue calico dress, complete with matching ribbons and little black shoes. Yeah, sorry, I said. I didn't have anything else with two arms and two legs, and I'm pressed for time. Ulsharavas, the Cabbage Patch doll, sighed and sat down in the circle, legs straight out like a teddy bear's. She struggled to pick up the comparatively large cup of whiskey and drank it down. It looked like she was taking a pull from a rain barrel, but she downed the whiskey in one shot. I don't know where it went, given that the doll didn't actually have a mouth or a stomach, but none of it spilled onto the floor. That done, she thrust a tiny fist into the tobacco and stuffed a wad of it into her mouth.
"So," she said between chews, "you want to know about the shroud and the people who stole it?"
I lifted my eyebrows. Yeah, actually. You're pretty good.
"There are two problems."
I frowned. "Okay, what are they?" Ulsharavas peered at me and said,
"First, I don't work for Bokur."
"I'm not a Bokur," I protested.
"You aren't a Hoongun. You aren't a Mambo. That makes you a sorcerer."
"Wizard," I said. "I'm with the White Council." The doll tilted her head.
"You're stained,"
she said.
"I can feel black magic on you."
"It's a long story," I said, "but mostly it isn't mine."
"Some of it is."
I frowned at the doll and then nodded. "Yeah, I've made a bad call or two."
"But honest,"
Ulsharavas noted.
"Well enough. Second is my price."
"What did you have in mind?" The doll spat to one side, flecks of tobacco landing on the floor.
"An honest answer to one question. Answer me, and I will tell you what you seek."
"Yeah, right," I said. "You could just ask me for my name. I've heard that one before."
"I didn't say you'd have to answer in full," the doll said. "I certainly do not wish to threaten you. But what you would answer, you must answer honestly."
I thought about it for a minute before I said, "All right, done." Ulsharavas scooped up more tobacco and started chomping.
"Answer only this. Why do you do what you do?"
I blinked at her. "You mean tonight?"
"I mean always,"
she answered.
"Why are you a wizard? Why do you present yourself openly? Why do you help other mortals as you do?"
I said. I stood up and paced over to my table. "What else would I do?"
"Precisely," the doll said, and spat. "You could be doing many other things. You could be seeking a purpose in life in other careers. You could be sequestered and studying. You could be using your skills for material gain and living in wealth. Even in your profession as an investigator, you could do more to avoid confrontation than you do. But instead, you consign yourself to a poor home, a dingy office, and the danger of facing all manner of mortal and supernatural foe. Why?"
I leaned back against my table, folded my arms, and frowned at the doll. "What the hell kind of question is that?"
"An important one," she said, "and one that you agreed to answer honestly."
"Well," I said, "I guess I wanted to do something to help people, something I was good at."
"Is that why?"
she asked. I chewed over the thought for a moment. Why had I started doing this stuff? I mean, it seemed like every few months I was running up against situations that had the potential to horribly kill me. Most wizards never had the kind of problems I did. They stayed at home, minded their own business, and generally speaking went on about their lives. They did not challenge other supernatural forces. They didn't declare themselves to the public at large. They didn't get into trouble for sticking their noses in other people's business, whether or not they'd been paid to do so. They didn't start wars, get challenged to duels with vampire patriots, or get the windows shot out of their cars. So why did I do it?
Was it some kind of masochistic death wish? Maybe a psychological dysfunction of some sort?
Why?
I don't know, I said finally. I guess I never thought about it all that much. The doll watched me with unnerving intensity for a full minute before nodding.
Don't you think you should?
I scowled down at my shoes and didn't answer. Ulsharovas took one last fistful of tobacco and sat back down in her original position, settling her calico dress primly about her.
The shroud and the thieves you seek have rented a small vessel docked in the harbor. It is a pleasure craft called the Etranger.
I nodded and exhaled through my nose. All right, then. Thank you for your help. She lifted a tiny hand.
One thing more, wizard. You must know why the Knights of the White God wish you to stay away from the Shroud.
I arched an eyebrow. Why?
They received part of a prophecy. A prophecy that told them that should you seek the Shroud, you will most assuredly perish.
Only part of a prophecy? I asked.
Yes. Their adversary concealed some of it from them.
I shook my head. Why are you telling me this?
Because, Ulsharovas said, you must hear the second half of the prophecy in order to restore the balance.
Okay. The doll nodded and fixed me with that unsettling, unblinking stare.
Should you seek the shroud, Harry Dresden, you will most assuredly perish.
All right, I said. So what happens if I don't? The doll lay down on her back, and wisps of light began flowing back out of her, back from whence Ulsharovas had come. Her voice came to me quietly, as if from a great distance.
If you do not, they all die, and this city with them.
Chapter 9. I hate cryptic warnings. I know the whole cryptic remark concept is part and parcel of the wizard gig, but it doesn't suit my style. I mean, what good is a warning like that? All three knights in the population of Chicago would die if I didn't get involved, and my number would be up if I did. That sounded like the worst kind of self-fulfilling crap. There's a case to be made for prophecy. Don't get me wrong. Mortals, even wizards, all exist at a finite point in the flow of time. Or, to make it simple, if time is a river, then you and I are like pebbles in it. We exist at one spot at a time, occasionally jostled back and forth by the currents. Spirits don't always have the same kind of existence. Some of them are more like a long thread than a stone, their presence tenuous, but rippling upstream and down is a part of their existence, experiencing more of the stream than the pebble. That's how oracle spirits know about the future and the past. They're living in them both. At the same time, they're delivering mysterious messages to you. That's why they only give brief warnings, or mysterious dreams, or prophetic knock-knock jokes, or however they drop their clues. If they tell you too much, it will change the future that they're experiencing. So they have to give out the advice with a light touch. I know. It makes my head hurt, too. I don't put much stock in prophecy. As extensive and aware as these spirits might be, they aren't all-knowing. And as nutty as people are, I don't buy that any spirit is going to be able to keep an absolute lock on every possible temporal outcome. Maybe genuine prophecies aside, I could hardly drop the case now. In the first place, I'd been paid up front, and I didn't have the kind of financial breathing space I would need to be able to turn down the money and pay my bills at the same time. In the second place, the risk of imminent death just didn't hit me the same way it used to. It wasn't that it didn't scare me. It did, in that kind of horrible, uncertain way that left me with nothing to focus my fears upon. But I've beaten risks before, and I could do it again. You want to know another reason I didn't back off? I don't like getting pushed around. I don't like threats. As well-intentioned and polite and caring as Michael's threat had been, it still made me want to punch someone in the nose. The Oracle's prophecy had been another threat of sorts, and I don't let spirits from the Never-Never determine what I'm going to do either. Finally, if the prophecy was right, Michael and his brother knights could be in danger, and they had saved my skinny wizard's ass not long ago. I could help them.
They might be heaven on wheels when it came to taking on bad guys in a fight, but they weren't investigators. They couldn't run these thieves down the way I could. It was just a question of making them see reason. Once I convinced them that the prophecy they'd received wasn't wholly correct, everything would be fine. Yeah, right. I shoved those thoughts aside and checked the clock. I wanted to move on Ulsharavas's tip.